Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, June 25th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel, which is Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Okay, so we have some interesting health updates. So we'll go with me first. So since my last recording, I had my MRI. I got it approved, and then I went to have my MRI. Had the MRI at the lovely radiology center right on UConn campus at Alethea Drive, and it was a pleasant experience. The ladies were very nice to me. I got to listen to jam band music while I was in the MRI. MRIs, I don't know if it seems like MRIs are becoming more efficient. I feel like my MRI, when I had my back done in 2011, I feel like I was in the MRI for a longer time. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I'm not sure. But I was only in the machine for 15 or 20 minutes. And, you know, you have to lie there and listen to the Industrial Symphony. It was not an open MRI, so I was in a tube. I didn't really mind. It was kind of close because you have to keep your arms close to your sides. But other than that, I was able to do deep breathing. She told me it was okay to do that because the machine corrects for the motion of breathing and the motion of your heart. I didn't realize that. What they can't correct for as easily is if you do intentional motion. So if you move your hands or you move your head or something, then you're going to get artifactual errors on the MRI. But I was able to be okay with that. They put headphones on you so you can listen to music, and so they can talk to you, and they'll tell you, all right, first we're going to do this. This part's going to take 90 seconds. Here's a minute to relax. This next part's going to take 90 seconds. And then you get to hear all the weirdo sounds of the magnets. It's just the most bizarre thing. It just makes me wonder, this is the best we got? But, you know, when you do an MRI, you can see a lot of good stuff. So the MRI was fine. And I also, my pain level had gone down considerably, not enough to get on the bike or go for walks, but I had been doing PT exercises and gentle yoga, and I was feeling pretty good. And then a week ago Sunday, we went to a cafe, and I sat on a bench while sipping on a matcha latte, and I sat there on that hard bench for a good 45 minutes. When I stood up, I had a terrible flare, so my femoral nerve just went crazy again, and it was like it was the first week of April all over again, or the last week of April all over again. It was very bad. I wound up being in bed for a couple days. I couldn't go to work for one of the work days that week, and I'm still recovering from that. I'm not as bad as I was last week, but I'm getting along, and I'm doing things. I'm mostly taking acetaminophen because I'm finding I can't tolerate NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like your naproxen or your ibuprofen. So I'm not taking any of those. I'm taking a lot of natural anti-inflammatories. And so I think, you know, everything helps a little bit. I had acupuncture yesterday, and I'll have chiropractic on Monday, so that's good. So in terms of what the MRI showed, the MRI, what was amazing is that I had the MRI in the morning on a Tuesday. By the afternoon, it was in my MyChart. I could look at the results. Somebody had already read it, and we knew what was going on. So guess what? I have severe spinal stenosis in my lumbar spine. The center of the stenosis is at L2, L3. And when they showed me the MRI, you could see this pinched spot, that there's not a lot of room in there. And so what that means is that there are structures that are inflamed, like the ligamentum flavum, which is a ligament that holds your spine up. It's inflamed, so it's crowding out space and pressing on the thecal sac. The thecal sac is the sac that surrounds your spinal cord and all the nerves that go through it. And the cauda equina is a bunch of nerves that go through your lumbar spine. That includes things like the nerves that arise to form your femoral nerve and your sciatic nerve. So my femoral nerve is affected. My sciatic is not. I don't have sciatica in either side. So the back of my legs are spared. Thank goodness. No, it's just femoral neuralgia and it's on the left side and that's it. So they showed me this. So I have the stenosis. I have stenosis at multiple levels, but the worst is L2, L3, which is where I have most of my symptoms. Although the doctor said that you're also having symptoms of L3, L4, which makes sense. And then I have a couple of herniated discs, which are higher up. And I have the damage starts at T12. So T12, L1, there's protrusion. And L1, L2, there's protrusion. And then there's less protrusion, but there's bulging all the way down. There's at T11, T12, I'm perfectly normal. And then at varying levels, there's varying degrees of facet arthropathy, which means that the joints that link your vertebrae together, they're rubbing against each other and they're inflamed. So they create a lack of space as well. And then the other thing that happens is you have the foramina. The foramens are the holes between the vertebrae where the nerve roots come out. And so I have a couple places where the foramina are narrowed. So that's going to cause nerve impingement as well. So that's all very exciting. I didn't realize I had stenosis. I thought maybe I just had some herniated disc, but I have stenosis as well. Apparently my stenosis is not as bad as Ron's because when I went to the doctor, they didn't jump to offering me, oh, you need a spinal fusion. They did not do that. They looked at, I was very alarmed, and Jocelyn, the lovely APRN, who I had seen in Simsbury, I saw her in Farmington, and she came in first, and she put the MRI up on the screen, and she pointed to lots of things on the MRI and told me, yeah, it's true, you don't have a lot of space there. She didn't seem to be as concerned as I was, which was kind of, that was kind of good. And she said, well, it really looks like you could benefit from an injection. She didn't say, yeah, you're going to have surgery for this. That wasn't how it went at all. It was very interesting. Like, okay, if that's what you think. So, I chatted with her for a bit and then she checked my signs. She checked to see, you know, what my experience of numbness was. And, you know, I told her about physically checked my legs. And I told her, yes, I have dysesthesia, paresthesia, change in sensation and numbness on that lateral left side, the outside left of my left leg, my left thigh, and it radiates sometimes down to the calf. And they said that because radiating down to the calf, that's more L3, L4. So then Dr. Malozzi came in, and Dr. Malozzi brought in a very nice resident named Mina, and Dr. Malozzi agreed with Jocelyn and said that you need an injection. That's where we would start. That you don't necessarily need surgery for this at this time. And I was very surprised because it just seems like everything is a mess in there. And when Dr. LaGuardia, my PCP, called me, he said, "Your back is a mess." And he offered me, Dr. LaGuardia offered me more medicine. He wanted to offer me opioids. He wanted to offer me tramadol, which is an opioid that, like a first line opioid that gets offered. I said, nope, not having the opioid. No, thank you. I said, I'm very concerned about taking tramadol because my mother gets very sick from it. My mother said to me, you know, you could try it. Maybe it won't happen to you because my sister doesn't get sick from it. But I'm like, I don't even want to chance it. I don't want to get addicted to an opioid. And when my pain is really bad, my pain only gets bad enough to take medicine for a few days at a stretch, and then it tends to alleviate. Because before this latest flare, I had stopped taking everything. I wasn't taking any pharmaceuticals at all. And I was managing it reasonably well. And what I was doing was topicals. And I'm continuing to do the topicals, and that still helps with the pain. So the issue is, so then they said, so we left it at that I was going to have an injection. And the only injection they give you for this is cortisone. The other interesting thing is it's not like they inject the cortisone into the ligamentum flavum, which is inflamed. they inject the cortisone. I didn't know this. They inject the cortisone into the spinal space. It's an epidural. They go beneath the dura, which is the hard collagenous structure that protects the spinal column. So they go inside there and they find a spot that's easy to get into, and they inject it, and it just diffuses. And then all of the structures that are inflamed calm down. That's what happens. Some people get a cortisone shot and they're all better for years. I am assuming that if I am not all better quickly, I don't know if they would do another cortisone shot or if they would then consider some kind of surgery. And since they're not they're not saying you need a fusion, I'm wondering if there's a little lower grade, like microdiscectomy or just cleanup or something that they can do that's not as intense as a fusion. I don't know. I don't know what that next step would be. So I'm going, the thing is, they left it at that, and then went to the scheduler, and then the scheduler could not get me in for the injection until like 3 weeks out. So the issue is that Ron is going to have surgery. And when you're listening to this, if you're listening on WHUS, well, I'm letting this is going to drop on June 25th. So Ron had his surgery yesterday and I haven't had my injection yet. So I'm not having my injection till next week. And so we have to hope that I can manage the pain so I can be there for Ron, when he has the surgery. And because it's improving, I'm hoping that it's going to. I had acupuncture yesterday, which I hope was somewhat helpful. Epsom salt baths are very helpful. If I wake up achy and in some pain in the morning, if I get in the bath and do an Epsom salt bath, I'm better afterwards. It's remarkable. So boy, if you have chronic pain, if you have back pain or knee pain or anything that can sit in an Epsom salt bath, I recommend it. It's really remarkable. I mean, it really, even if it doesn't get rid of your pain completely, if I have pain, when I sit down into the tub, it goes away. It's incredible because it's magnesium. So the magnesium salts are hitting your nerves and they are calming all the nerves down. So, and it does it right away. It's really nice. So I have Epsom salt baths that have lavender in them. I have plain Epsom salt baths, to which I add lavender essential oil. And I'm taking an Epsom salt bath almost every day. And, you know, if I miss sometimes, that's fine. But right now, it's hard for me to stand up for a long time, so I haven't been taking showers. So I take a bath. And I'll take a bath before work, even. And it sets me up right for the day. And then if I have to sit in a chair for a long time at work, that's when the acetaminophen comes on board. So then the other thing is I learned things about acetaminophen. So acetaminophen, not a good idea to take more than 4,000 milligrams in a day. That's what's recommended on all of the bottles that you see. And if I take it, I'm taking somewhere between 500 to 1,500 milligrams a day, and that's it. Yesterday I only took 500 because for some reason, Fridays are generally better. And so I do better on Fridays, I think, because I don't see as many patients. There's not as much chart work coming in. So I can get up and down from my desk and I can spend more time in my beanbag chair at the office. And also I'm a little more relaxed because I know the day's going to end sooner than it ends on Tuesday and Thursday. So as usual, I had a pretty good Friday. I was pleased with that, which ended with acupuncture. And then Monday coming, I will have chiropractic, which will be very nice. And then Dr. Scott can look at my amazing MRI. So I'm going to have a cortisone shot, and I'm hoping when they instill that cortisone into me, I will be back on my bike within days. I don't know. Of course, you start out really slowly. I haven't been on my bike since the end of April, or since, you know, mid-April, really. And, I'm going to have to start back slowly. I just can't believe I have all these setbacks, and, you know, I'm riding and I'm getting stronger and really happy. And then I have a setback and I'm off the bike for weeks, and it's going to have been a good 2 months or something by the time I get back on my bike, as long as that cortisone shot works. However, there are people who say, like I said, the cortisone shots work great. And, you know, I may have a shot and I'll be done with this for a while. I mean, I'll still have to do my PT exercises and keep my back strong and do core stuff and yoga and all that stuff. And hopefully that'll help. So there you go. And then as far as Ron goes, Ron is, as you're listening to this, Ron had his surgery yesterday, but I can't comment on it because I'm recording before he had his surgery. So the next time I record, we'll give you an idea of what happened there. So I'll, the next time I record will probably be after the surgery. So anyway, so that's what's going on there. So I'm still managing with topicals, and one of my favorite ones is that it has menthol, camphor, and capsaicin in it. I like the capsaicin because it is a counter irritant to nerve pain. It's a really good one for nerve pain. The other thing that I just discovered, I mean, I don't know that I just discovered it, but it was brought to my attention, is acetyl L-carnitine. So I started taking that. I read up on it and I realized it's good for neuropathic pain. So I'm like, where have you been all my life? So, and it's not going to, you know, it's not like taking gabapentin or pregabalin. It's not an anti-seizure medication. It's not going to have weird side effects. So I put that on board. I got some powder and I'm going to order some caps, and I'll put the powder into my tea and I will get the caps, and I'm going to probably take a gram in the morning and a gram in the evening. And we'll see how that goes. I've only been taking it for 2 days, so I don't know how much it's going to help in that amount of time. But I'm excited about it. So if you have nerve pain, acetyl L-carnitine is something you can try. What I will do for the next time I talk is we'll really do a deep dive on the benefits of acetyl L-carnitine. But it's not plain carnitine. L-carnitine and acetyl L-carnitine are not the same thing. What's interesting is when I dumped the powder into my tea, it gave off a vinegar odor. And I'm like, oh no, my tea's going to taste like vinegar. But it didn't. I think what happened is when it went into the water, it released the vinegar. So hopefully that doesn't mean that it released the acetyl portion of it. That would be concerning, because the acetyl group is what makes it more neurologically active than plain carnitine. Anyway, so we'll see how it works. We'll see what happens. And, you know, I'm willing to try, especially if they're natural medicine things, I'm certainly willing to try those. I have another acupuncture in a week. And I have a bunch of chiro appointments set up, so that'll be helpful. All right. And so poor Ron is still plugging along. He doesn't have pain the way that I have pain. He just has fatigue and weakness. And he gets sore, but he doesn't have nerve pain like I have, which is really interesting. And he has cramping and, cramping and twitching and things like that. And the more active he is, the worse it is. So that's what's going on with our health. So let's move on to some topics. Let's see. So let's talk about the loneliness epidemic. I was watching that. It's something that's really a concern. A lot of people are lonely. And I must say, I feel some of that because I feel like with the pain that I have had, my world has gotten a little bit smaller. I had to cancel a conference and a trip to see my mother. I don't go out a lot. I went to a cafe and hurt myself just from sitting on a bench. Ron is going to go hear some music tonight. I'm not going to go with him because I can't sit in a chair. So, I have to lie back. That's how that works. So, yesterday I had a wonderful experience. My friend Frances, who is one of my friends from Oregon, she was driving down to, she's in the process of driving down to the coast. She, had flown to Spain. She's going to get a house in Spain. And she had to go to Spain to do some work with her house. And she drove up to Boston to fly out. And she has people all the way up the coast and in the Boston area. So she was going to visit these various people. And then on the way back down, she got a hold of me and said, look, I'm going to be in, I'm going to come through your way tomorrow on Friday, and I'll stop and see you. So it worked out that I could only see her for 20 minutes because I had 20, when she got there, I had 20 minutes till a patient. And so we spent that 20 minutes together, but it was wonderful. It was just so wonderful to see a friend. It just felt so good to see somebody who I was close to. And it was a really nice time to just look at her and give her a hug and talk to her and talk about what was going on. It was just really tremendous. So hanging around with people and hanging around with friends can be a really great thing. I didn't have as good an experience as when I went to the, I went to a tailgate party for the bike club. I think I was just upset because my pain was a little up that day, and it was just making me sad to look at all these people who had just had a great bike ride and were feeling real proud and happy about themselves. So that's been hard to not be able to be on the bike and watch other people having lives. I mean, I look at the TV and I see people walking and I'm going, or walking or dancing, and I'm like looking at that going, wow, that must be great to like go for walks and dance and not even think about it like it ain't no thing. Hopefully those days are coming to a close. I'm hoping that by the end of July, I'll have a better, you know, rest of my 2025. I mean, 2025 wasn't doing too badly until April 23rd, when my femoral nerve decided that it had enough of being kind to me, that it needed to freak out and scream and be compressed by structures, and, you know, that then who knew that I had this major spinal stenosis and that my nerves are upset because of it. So here's what's going on with loneliness. The Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, placed a spotlight on the problem with loneliness, and he declared it an epidemic in the spring of 2023. And he even wrote a letter that introduced an advisory that it's more than just a bad feeling and represents a major public health risk for both individuals and society. He also said that although many people grew lonelier during the COVID-19 pandemic, about half of American adults had already reported experiences of loneliness even before the outbreak. In the past few years, researchers from Harvard, the Graduate School of Education, Making Caring Common Project, are investigating the underlying causes of loneliness. They conducted a national survey with YouGov to find out what Americans had to say, and here are some of the findings. So here's who's lonely. 21% of adults in the survey reported they had serious feelings of loneliness. And here are the ages. People between 30 to 44 years of age were the loneliest group. 29% of people in this age range said they were frequently or always lonely. 18 to 29 years old, it was only 24%. 45 to 64 year olds, 20, and 65 and older had the lowest rate of loneliness. 10% felt lonely. So what's the difference between older people? So I'm going to get into the article, but I'm going to make some postulates here. The older you get, the less likely you are to live on your devices, because we didn't grow up living on devices and we still believe in things like, you know, going and hanging out with each other. When you're 65 and older, you're more likely to be retired. So when you're retired, you're more likely to spend time with people in a way that you like. If you're not working, if you're at work, maybe you hang out with people that you like from work, but most of the time you're just working. And if you're in the middle of doing your job, that's not the same as having pleasant, fulfilling interactions with people that has no stake in it, has no consequence. So people who are 65 and older tend to be retired, so they tend to be able to do that. Also, so people 65 and older don't live on their devices the way that people who are younger do. 45 to 60, and so as you see, as people get older, it gets lower. And I think the 45 to 64 year olds, most of them are still working. Again, we're from a generation that did not live on their phones, you know, that they didn't live on their devices. And so we're more likely to go spend time with people. So people who are 30 to 44, those are sort of millennial age people. And they were the first generation to have a significant amount of life living, like their life advances on their devices. And so they don't spend time with people. So then they're going to feel lonely. You know, you see your person online, but you never get together with people because you're just so busy being in your devices. And I've heard people talking about when they go into, they were talking about how you would go into a cafeteria at a university and people are sitting there and it's quiet because nobody's talking to each other. Everybody's on their devices. So that's something that you see. So it's very interesting. And, you know, it's important to have human interaction. We are social creatures. We're sort of pack animals. So our nature is to want to be around other people, and people who tend to be loners tend to not be as happy. That's not always true. I can't generalize that, but it tends to be true. So anyway, so here's what the article says. There's no real gender differences found. Men and women both experienced similar rates of loneliness. There weren't major differences based on political ideology or race or ethnicity, but adults with more than one racial identity had higher levels of loneliness. So that's interesting. 42% reported that they were lonely. So that may have to do with not being sure where you fit in, that you have pushback from. So if you're a couple of racial identities, you might have pushback from either of the racial identities saying, oh, you're not really white, you're not really African, or you're not really Asian, or whatever it happens to be. But that's only 42%. That means that that means that 58% don't feel that way. So that's okay. So income and education, there were notable differences between income, but not education levels. Americans earning less than $30,000 a year were the loneliest. 29% in this category reported feeling lonely, while 19% of Americans earning between $50,000 to $100,000, 18% of those making more than $100,000 said they were lonely. So probably when it's a financial thing, when you're not making a lot of money, you're working really hard to make ends meet. And so you're probably working harder than the people who are making more money. You know, if they're making more money, that may come along with ability to take more time off and not work as many hours. And I mean, not always, but it comes with the ability to take vacations and take more time off and have more benefits. And it's really sad. The more money people had, the less loneliness there was. So the more money you have, the more, I think it's the more free time you have, the more ability you have to take time off, spend time with people, spend time doing things that you want to do. And whatever makes you happy, you can do. I mean, it really is lousy to say this, but it looks like whatever you want to do to make you happy, the more money you have, the more ability you have to do that. And that's not always true. There are people who don't have a lot of money who are very happy, because look at the statistic. 29% report feeling lonely. That means that 71% don't feel lonely. So it's really a low percentage of people. I mean, many more people than not don't feel lonely by income versus education. So what does it feel like to be lonely? The Surgeon General's advisory, loneliness is described as a state of mind, which is a subjective distressing experience that results from perceived isolation or inadequate meaningful connections, where inadequate means the discrepancy or unmet need between an individual's preferred and actual experience. So the MCC report helps to further explain why social isolation is not the same as loneliness. So one person in the survey who experienced loneliness described having plenty of family members around them, but not feeling appreciated by them. Another person said they were surrounded by other people who were only present in my life because I'm useful to them. So that's interesting, too. If you have toxic relationships, even if you have a lot of people around you, you're going to still feel lonely. So there are mental health challenges when you're lonely. So the research has found a strong correlation between loneliness and mental health concerns. 81% of adults who were lonely also said they suffered with anxiety or depression, compared to 29% of those who were less lonely. They also noted a complex interaction between troubled feelings. Loneliness, anxiety, and depression all feed into each other. So some of the causes of loneliness, technology. 73% of those who surveyed selected technology as contributing to loneliness in the country. That's what I just said. Insufficient time with family. I get it. I don't get to see my mother. I don't get to see my sister and her family as nearly as often as I would like. Because why? Because I have health issues and because I live far away from them. And I have to work so much because, you know, I don't have an income that allows me to have more mobility. So I have those three things, the income, the distance, and the income, the distance, and I have health issues that make it hard for me to travel. So people, and specifically people who were overworked or too busy or tired, 62% of the survey picked that concern. So a lot of people are working too hard, so they don't get to go spend time with their friends. When they're, you know, done with work, they're exhausted and they have to recover from having been working. Mental health challenges that harm relationships. 60% of people rated this as a significant problem. So people are having problems in their relationships. Living in an individualistic society, that's a problem too, that people expect you to pull yourself up by your bootstraps when there's, I've heard it suggested, there's no such thing as pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. You always have outside assistance helping you to make it up any kind of a ladder. So being too individualistic means that you're not necessarily expected to spend time with other people or get support from other people. The other thing is no religious or spiritual life. Too much focus on your own feelings. The changing nature of work, with more Remote work and hybrid schedules also were perceived causes of loneliness. So you might be more lonely. It might be great to work from home, but when you work from home, you don't get to see anybody. So it's a double-edged sword because it's very nice to be able to be home. You don't necessarily have to dress up. If you have children, you can spend more time with the children. You don't have a commute. You save money. There are a lot of things you save money on. You're not as likely to go out to lunch. You can take a break and go take a nap in your own bed. There's a lot of benefits to, if you have a pet, you can interact with the pet much more readily. So that's a nice thing. But the other side of that is you don't go into the office and you don't see people. So what should we do to tackle loneliness? So one of the things to do is to reach out to family or friends, spend more time with people who you love and like spending time with. Learn about self-love, taking care of yourself, learn to be more forgiving of others and find ways to help others. So another way to be less lonely is to volunteer, is to do activities where you are taking care of other people who are not you. I talk to people about that, but people who are lonely and they don't know what to do with themselves, I suggest that get into volunteering, because then you're doing something. It takes you out of yourself and you get to make someone else's life better. That makes you feel really good. You get a lot of good feelings from doing that. So that can be helpful. And the other thing is it would be great to have spaces, green spaces to go where people could be out in nature. If you're stuck in a big city and you have to work a lot and you don't get to be in a park or a woods or at the beach or somewhere where there's more nature. And also if there are not a lot of community events, if we had more things like that, that would be helpful. And, you know, we need more community focused green spaces and also playgrounds when you have children. So that's a very interesting thing. So I saw that in the news and I thought that would be an interesting thing to talk about because a lot of people are struggling with loneliness. And if you are, my heart goes out to you. There are things that you can do about it. Think about reaching out to a friend, reaching out to a family member you haven't talked to in a while, even if it's on your device, and maybe it'll turn into going and spending time with people. The other thing you can do is instead of sitting drinking tea on your porch, which is a nice thing to do, is go to a cafe and you'll meet people and just hang out there and you'll see people you might know. So don't necessarily feel like you have to reach out to a specific person. You can join a club, go to a group, or the easiest thing is really go to a cafe, a bar if you like to drink, but you know, you don't want to drink too much alcohol. But if you go to a cafe, you don't necessarily have to get coffee. You can get, depending on what your caffeine situation is, you can get things that don't have coffee in them. You can go to a smoothie bar even, or a cafe that serves things other than caffeinated beverages, and just sit there. You can sit there with your device or a book, and you may meet people. That's an easy way to be around other people. And the other thing would be to go to a local green space if you have one nearby you, and just go for a walk and see who you meet. And the other thing is, if you live in a city, go to a museum or go to the library, and you'll run into people there, and you might strike up a conversation. All right, so the next thing we're going to talk about now is we're going to move back to more natural therapies that have to do with menopause. So menopause is an interesting topic to me because I am postmenopausal and I have some symptoms of menopause. And there's numerous things that you can do to make yourself feel better around your menopause. So there's a lot of natural therapies that can help you with your menopausal symptoms. So one of them is ashwagandha root, although I can't do ashwagandha root because it pushes the inhibitory amino acid GABA, which is a good thing if you tend to be intense and stressed and stuff and you're having trouble sleeping. You want to have more GABA on board because it is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It helps calm you down. And ashwagandha increases your GABA levels. Well, it increases them too much for me and it knocks me out. But otherwise, ashwagandha is a really lovely herb. It can help with menopausal symptoms and it can help with perimenopause. Ashwagandha is calming because of the GABA, and it also has constituents in it that support your immune system. It helps your immune system to work better. So it calms inflammation, and it specifically has compounds in it that are anti-hyaluronidase. So hyaluronidase is, for example, There's hyaluronidase, which is an enzyme that breaks down hyaluronic acid. Hyaluronic acid is a humectant compound that helps with the softening of your skin, and it helps softening of many tissues and the softening of your joints. So your joints are going to be more hydrated and less brittle if they have adequate hyaluronic acid on board. Well, hyaluronidase is made by Lyme disease. Lyme spirochetes make hyaluronidase, and ashwagandha blocks hyaluronidase. So ashwagandha is something that if you have joint pain because of inflammation, and especially if joint pain because of Lyme disease, ashwagandha is something we like to include in formulas for Lyme disease because of its anti-hyaluronidase benefits. And joint pain is one of the consequences of menopause, of the reduced estrogen and progesterone that you have in your body. So ashwagandha helps with mild to moderate menopause symptoms, and it also and so other therapies, hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, and those can actually help the vasomotor symptoms. So when you're getting hot flashes and stuff, those things can help with your sexual dysfunction, your reduced desire for sex, and can also help with your sleep disturbances. So you can get some basic things: cognitive behavioral therapy. Kind of behavioral therapy and hypnosis, and just general meditation is going to be helpful for those things. So while you're transitioning in menopause, as I said, meditation, you're going to be incorporating relaxation practices and mindfulness-based stress reduction techniques. Those are helpful. So that's going to be whatever kind of meditation you like. I like to recommend any kind of guided meditation, because then you don't have to figure it out and think about how to do it. And YouTube is a great resource for that. There's a bazillion different kinds of guided meditation, and you can just find someone or something that you like on YouTube and online, and you can do it at home. You can also find meditation groups, and then you can take care of your loneliness too, right? But there's lots of stuff available online, and you can use any device to access it. So it's right in the palm of your hands, or, you know, on your TV or whatever device you may use to access YouTube. I happen to like Yoga Nidra. And Yoga Nidra is a very specific guided meditation. All it is, Yoga Nidra is not moving yoga. You lie down or you get into the most comfortable position you can get into and stay in for a while. So when I do Yoga Nidra, I tend to lie on my back with pillows, and if it's cold, blankets and a bolster under my knees. And I just find a position that makes me really, really comfortable that I can stay in for however long I'm going to do the Yoga Nidra meditation. And then the person leading the Yoga Nidra gives you guidance, and it's a guided relaxation, a progressive relaxation of all of the parts of your body. So they tell you to relax your head, the top of your head, and they go through specific parts of your body, and they go all the way down till before you know it, your whole body is relaxed. And if you go online, you'll find that there are many different lengths of guided meditations. You can do them for, there's short as 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 17 minutes, half an hour, an hour and a half. Lots and lots of options there. So you don't have to feel like that if you're going to meditate, you have to carve out an hour to do it. You do not. And if you're not used to it and you're not used to sitting still for that long, it might be a good idea to start shorter, to start with something like 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. So you can see that if you can do it, and you have to figure out what your edge is. Personally, for my meditation, I prefer to do yin and restorative yoga, because I do like to have the stretching going on, and getting into the different stretches I find is very meditative for me. I tend to prefer that to Yoga Nidra, although I have trouble doing that now because when my nerve is flared, it's harder to get into those stretches. But if you don't feel like sitting absolutely still for that amount of time is going to work for you, then you can check out Yoga Nidra, or yoga, yin yoga and restorative yoga. And there are lots of practices online for that. And you can also check in with your local yoga studio to see if they have yin and restorative classes for you, which you can attend in person or by Zoom. If you attend live yoga classes by Zoom, you could attend a yoga class anywhere in the world. So that's something to consider. And meanwhile, again, YouTube is your friend. You can go on YouTube and find lots of recorded yoga nidra, yin yoga, and restorative yoga classes. And anything that involves being still and doing deep breathing is going to help you calm down. It helps you to access the ventral vagus nerve. When you have access to the ventral vagus nerve, it calms everything down. So all of your calming practices are going to work. So yin and restorative yoga and yoga nidra all help you to do that. And they will also help to calm the hormones that give you the vasomotor symptoms. I know that when I was getting more hot flashes, they would tend to happen more if I'm stressed. You know, if I were in the middle of a stressful visit with a patient, I would be more likely to have a hot flash. If I have a lot of pain, I might be more inclined to get a sweat or something like that. I'm not getting as many sweats as I used to. I think I may be that much further along in my menopause journey, and I may be taking some good things that are helping too, because I take evening primrose oil and fish oil and curcumin and green tea. There's a lot of things that I take that are helpful for that. So relaxation practices, mindful-based stress reduction, also using a sauna, and they suggest daily. So if you're going to do it daily, probably no more than 20 minutes. You could do it less. But there are studies on sauna use that can help menopausal women avoid weight gain. And the saunas can help improve insulin sensitivity and fat metabolism. So that's something that now your friendly local yoga studio might have sauna there. So you could check that out. And you can also get saunas for your home. And if you're going to get one, you might want to get far infrared. You can get a small sauna that you can sit in. You can also get sauna blankets or sauna pads, like far infrared pads that you can lie on, and far infrared blankets, and they will have that effect as well. And then you can do it at home anytime that you feel like it. So for perimenopausal and menopausal women, natural progesterone, which is an estrogen antagonist, can be useful. So the benefits extend far beyond menopause. One of the things that happens is women who don't have uteruses are offered estrogen. They're not offered progesterone. I believe that is wrong, because you still need progesterone. And progesterone is the thing that you're lacking in menopause more than your estrogen, because your body still has estrogen in it when you're postmenopausal. You just don't always see it in the bloodstream. It's hanging out in your organs. But progesterone, the only way to make progesterone is either to ovulate or to be pregnant, because the corpus luteum, when you ovulate, the half of the follicle, the follicle breaks and becomes future potential baby or ovum. The other half becomes corpus luteum, stays in your on your ovary and tells the other follicles to go to sleep, because ideally we only want to have one baby at a time. So the progesterone tells it to go to sleep, and then it also helps to maintain a healthy uterine lining so that you can implant. And you only get 2 weeks out of the corpus luteum, and so after 2 weeks, either you get pregnant or you don't. If you don't get pregnant, you have no more progesterone, and you lose your uterine lining. You have your menses. And if you do get pregnant, then you have a placenta, and the placenta takes over the manufacturing of the progesterone, and then you have tons of progesterone for your entire pregnancy. And it does wonderful anti-inflammatory things. A lot of women find that if they have autoimmune conditions or other inflammatory conditions, they abate while they are in pregnancy. If they have polycystic ovaries and they manage to get pregnant, their polycystic ovaries sometimes completely goes into remission and may not come back. Sometimes it does after pregnancy, but it goes into remission while you're pregnant, because you just have too much progesterone. That progesterone reduces the inflammation, and all those unfriendly cysts that make the extra hormones, they involute. They just calm down. So progesterone can be really helpful. It modulates, it helps, it's calming. So it's good to take estrogen before you go to sleep. It supports your neurological health. It reduces allergic responses. And men and women can benefit from progesterone. Before considering using it, you have to make sure you understand it's not a magic bullet, and that you want to eat a healthy diet as well. So you want to be eating your fruits and vegetables, your clean protein, your legumes. You want to just be eating a general healthy diet. Once you get your diet healthfully on board, then other things that can help counteract estrogen excess is to do the estrogen transmucosally. That is my favorite way for people to use estrogen. I like people to use estrogen oil. And there are products that are sold, and they tell you that you really should put them on your skin. And I don't think it absorbs as well as it does when it goes into your, when you do it on your gums or under your tongue. I'm not taking progesterone now, but I'm considering it, because it just can be so beneficial. So I like the progesterone oil, and the progesterone oil, you put it under your tongue, or you can rub it on your gums, and, it can be really helpful. Now you can get progesterone oil from a company. Like, what you have to do is you have to get a doctor that's willing to prescribe it for you. And then there are companies that make progesterone oil that's meant to be taken orally, and you put it under your tongue. And because I have some, I used to get it from a particular pharmacy. It can be beneficial. So DHEA and pregnenolone can also be beneficial, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And the cool thing about, so progesterone, you can keep measuring it, but you kind of know that a postmenopausal woman is not going to be producing progesterone. So you could test it if you want to, but it's probably better to just titrate up the dose and find a dose that gives you what you're looking for. Good sleep, better energy, reduced inflammation. And the other thing, so here's an interesting thing about transdermal progesterone, using progesterone cream. Your skin makes 5-alpha reductase, which is an enzyme that breaks down progesterone, and there's a lot of it in your skin. So if you put the progesterone on your skin, it's going to be converted and not usable. So the thing is that a lot of it's unfortunate. So what that means is a significant portion of the progesterone you're taking is converted into allopregnenolone and can't be converted into progesterone. So you're not going to get the progesterone benefits. When progesterone is used on your gums or under your tongue, the FDA thinks that somehow it converts into a drug, and it won't let any company from advising it on its label. So companies that promote their progesterone products as topical, even though you technically could probably use them under your tongue. So I don't necessarily recommend this, because what this article is suggesting is get some progesterone oil over the counter, use it under your tongue, even though it says to use it transdermally. I think it's a better idea, because they do make progesterone oil that is meant to be used under your tongue. It's just, as he says, the FDA says now it's a prescription. So get a prescription. Find a nice doctor who will prescribe it for you. You can find one. So I had doctors prescribe it for me. There's a few doctors in the area who will definitely do that. And you just get the progesterone oil from the bioidentical hormone companies and they create the progesterone for that purpose. Mine was raspberry flavored. Yeah. So you work with a bioidentical hormone company and they're giving you oral products, you can get them flavored. And mine was raspberry. So it is legal for any physician to recommend an off-label indication for a drug to their patient. So probably a prescription, and caveat is it's a doctor with prescriptive authority. So I don't have prescriptive authority in the state of Connecticut, so it's not a good idea for me to tell people to use something in an off-label way. So technically, I'm not supposed to do that. But your MD can do that. Your MD, your DO, your APRN, your PA, anybody who has prescriptive authority can do that. Again, better to simply go with the bioidentical hormone company that have them give you a prescription, and then you have bioidentical oil that you can put under your tongue and off you go. So progesterone is a natural hormone. It's not really a drug, and it's safe in high doses, and you have to use natural bioidentical progesterone. Progestin will not do the same thing. It doesn't have the same health benefits, and it can cause cancer. So don't let a doctor give you progestin. Don't let them give you medroxyprogesterone or other things that are not bioidentical progesterone. You can also be offered oral micronized progesterone, which is progesterone in a pill, usually in peanut oil. Now, mind you, if you have peanut allergy, you don't want that one. But, you know, if you get the sublingual oil, it's generally not in peanut oil. I don't remember it tasting like peanuts. So you can, it's a hormone, it's not a drug, it's safe in high doses. progestins or not. So progestins are found in, like, when you get conjugated estrogens with progestin in it. Medroxyprogesterone is a synthetic progestin. It does not have the same effects. It's not anti-inflammatory in the same way that natural progesterone is, and it can cause blood clots. So it's you really want to get natural progesterone. And when you take chemical contraception, any chemical contraception that has a progestin in it, it's always progestin. It has to be, because it has to block your progesterone receptors. If it had natural progesterone in it, you could get pregnant. I had a patient come in at some point, or I've had it happen a couple times, where they were taking natural progesterone and also taking birth control. I said, listen, you have to make a choice. If you want to use the natural progesterone, you can't use chemical contraception, because if you have natural progesterone and birth control with progestin in it, they are competing for the same receptors. And the end result is that if you're taking a chemical contraceptive for contraception, the natural progesterone will render your chemical contraception, it'll render it, it'll make it so it doesn't work. So it competes with the receptor sites, and it won't work anymore. So you can't take natural progesterone and birth control with progestin in it at the same time. And all birth control, like all chemical contraception, has progestin in it. You're not going to find an estrogen only chemical contraception, because the idea is that the estrogen, the synthetic estrogen, is going to the synthetic estrogen is more it's proliferative, it's carcinogenic, and the progestin is in there to moderate those effects. So it's always going to be in there. And progestin plus estrogen, the ethinyl estradiol that's usually in chemical contraception, is going to prevent conception. But natural progesterone will not. It enhances conception. So if you're taking them at the same time and the progesterone hits those sites and you get enough progesterone in there, there's not room for the progestin to bind and you could get pregnant. So don't do that. Let's see. So there's a doctor named Ray Peet who's done work on progesterone, and he was a great expert on progesterone and wrote his PhD on it back in 1982, and spent his professional career documenting the need to counteract the dangers of excess estrogen with low LA diets and transmucosal progesterone supplementation. So he determined that most solvents don't dissolve progesterone and discovered that vitamin E is the best solvent to optimally provide progesterone in your tissue. Vitamin E also protects you against damage from, and so you just need to be very careful about which vitamin E you use. Most supplemental vitamin E's on the market. So when you use vitamin E, you want to look for a vitamin E that has tocotrienols in it. So you can get anatotocotrienols, you can get vitamin E with anatotocotrienols. You don't want to get vitamin E acetate. You don't want to get just D-alpha tocopherol. You certainly don't want to get DL-alpha tocopherol, because the L part is not active in the body at all. You want to avoid any synthetic vitamin E, like alpha tocopherol acetate. The acetate indicates that it's synthetic. Natural vitamin E will say D-alpha tocopherol, and your body can use that. And you want the complete spectrum of tocopherols and tocotrienols. You want the beta, gamma, and delta tocopherols, and the effective D isomer. And you can look at the label and find out. So what I recommend generally for vitamin E, and I take myself, I'm taking anatotocotrienols right now for my vitamin E. So you can get progesterone as powder. You can get it as sublingual oil. You can get it in a bunch of forms. But I agree with this writer that the best way to take progesterone is as a sublingual product. So you have to measure out the correct dose for you. And it does increase GABA. So I would have to be real careful about how much I took, because I'm sensitive to GABA. So you take your progesterone at night because it'll help you sleep better. And if you're having trouble sleeping as a, in your perimenopause, progesterone can be a big help. And so if you're still menstruating, you can still take natural progesterone. You want to only take it during the luteal phase of your cycle. That is after you ovulate and before you menstruate. And you can, so you start the progesterone 10 days after the first day of your period and stopping it when your period starts. That's what I generally, if a menstruating woman needs to take natural progesterone, that's what I usually tell them. And I will tell that to, so women who have postpartum depression, natural progesterone can be helpful for postpartum depression because a lot of times postpartum depression is because the woman is not handling the precipitous drop in progesterone. So, you know, you have a ton of progesterone being produced when you have a placenta and then all of a sudden you don't. And if you're under a lot of stress, then you're not able to ease into a different hormonal state. And it can be helpful to take progesterone if you have postpartum depression. So if you are a male or a woman who doesn't menstruate, like a postmenopausal woman, or, you know, you have had a hysterectomy and so you don't get periods or you don't have ovaries, you can take the progesterone every day for 4 to 6 months and then cycle off for a week. And so you take the progesterone like 30 minutes before you want to go to sleep because of its anti-cortisol function, and it's GABA. It's increase in GABA. The writer is a guy, and he's been taking progesterone himself, and it works well for him. So men can do progesterone too. It has the same anti-inflammatory effects, anti-proliferative effects, and mood effects, and, you know, helps with sleep. So men can take it too. So apparently you don't always see men taking it, but people who offer bioidentical hormones will often offer it to men. So yeah, so I think we don't have a lot of time left. Actually, I think I can wrap up now. So that was very interesting. So we talked about, you know, some things for spinal stenosis. If you have spinal stenosis and you have pain, consider using a topical that has camphor. That's menthol, maybe camphor, but definitely menthol. Can have camphor, can also have capsaicin in it. I like the capsaicin because it's a counter irritant for nerves. And so that can be really helpful. And then I also happen to like topical magnesium. I have both magnesium oil, which is basically magnesium chloride dissolved in water, which feels oily. It's not technically an oil, but it feels oily. And the one I have now has frankincense oil in it as well, which is a wonderful anti-inflammatory. So I'm using that. I also have I have Epsom salt lotion, which I put on. So that has actual Epsom salts, which is magnesium sulfate in it. And I put that on and it has lavender and it's very relaxing. I love to use it at night. So that's helpful too. So those are great topicals. So I'm going to go and then I'll be back. I'll be back with more Radio Naturopath. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcasts at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND for 30 days after recording. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.